repeat common mistakes, and do not learn as much from other projects as they might. Nor do product units have processes in place to follow up on suggestions consistently. Similarly, products are now large and complicated, and functional jobs, writing specifications and manuals, developing and testing code, have become correspondingly complicated. Yet much of what people learn is still communicated orally, from person to person, and from one group to another. Fourth, retaining employees is critical because so much knowledge is tacit and communicated orally rather than written down. Retention rates appear high after a person stays in Microsoft for several years. Testers tire of testing, though, and developers and program managers grow weary of changing specifications and code under extremely tight deadlines that they themselves feel pressured to set. The career tracks, opportunities for promotion, or interesting technical challenges help people stay motivated, but many people burn out and leave or take extended vacations. Microsoft's testing and daily build processes, in particular, rely very heavily on extremely bright people to find and fix obscure defects quickly. Developers and testers already have impressive automated tests and checklists that capture some process and product knowledge. They could capture more knowledge, however, by more consistently documenting a product's design and implementation structure. The trade-off here, of course, is the time needed to keep documents up to date versus the current ease of changing the product. In any case, vulnerability to tacit knowledge and employee turnover will increase as products become even more varied functionally and difficult to build. Competing with products and standards. There are several strategic issues that we discuss in the next section as challenges to Microsoft. Here, we would like to highlight four potential weaknesses in Microsoft's product portfolio and competitive strategy. It is difficult to move from incremental innovation to truly radical innovation or invention. It is difficult but necessary to balance being technology-driven with being consumer and content-driven. Content-driven products are cumbersome to internationalize. A company can lose focus by diversifying into many markets, even closely related ones. One problem we see is that Microsoft has relied primarily on incremental innovations to compete. Occasionally, it bunches these innovations together, combines them with some new technologies, and introduces new products that make old ones obsolete. Windows 3.1, Windows NT, and Windows 95 all appear to be radical innovations compared to any version of MS-DOS. Yet the underlying technologies, as well as the style of development and product introduction, still represent mostly incremental innovation. Though it should be enormously successful as a product, even Windows 95 is similar to the 10-year-old Macintosh operating system. It also builds extensively on Windows 3.1, with MS-DOS code still present within the system, and some features borrowed from Windows NT. In the last few years, Microsoft has created new divisions for advanced consumer products, an online network, and research. It has also established dozens of partnerships and made numerous acquisitions. We believe that all these initiatives significantly expand Microsoft's capabilities. The company remains vulnerable, however, to competition from more specialized firms that are better at inventing new technologies or introducing innovative products for new markets. These companies have included Intuit with Quicken in personal finance software, Novell with NetWare for office networking, and Lotus with Notes for office groupware. A second weakness is that Microsoft may need to become even more consumer-driven and content-driven than it is now. It has non-programmers in high-ranking positions, thousands of marketing and salespeople, and hundreds of program managers and product planners who try to act as advocates for customers. In addition, the Advanced Consumer Systems and Consumer Systems divisions are helping Microsoft shift more resources and attention to the largest mass market, the novice home user. But although Bill Gates and other senior people have access to enormous amounts of data on customers, they still see much of the world in terms of software that Microsoft can sell. Applications development teams, in turn, tend to see the world in terms of features and products they can build. This is not all bad. The ability to create software technologies and specific features and products enables Microsoft to enter a variety of new markets with at least something to offer. At the same time, however, other factors will probably drive future sales of home consumer products and information highway services: content, low prices, ease of use, and ease of access. Microsoft, and Gates personally, are constantly acquiring entertainment, education, and information content. The company is learning how to make products easier to use, and it often lowers prices, as seen in Office. These are all the right things to do, strategically. Still, Microsoft has little background in content or novice consumer products. Microsoft also faces stiff potential challenges from large, powerful competitors, ranging from telecommunications companies and video game software producers to book publishers and movie production houses. Video game hardware and software producers are another source of competition, although they may actually expand the market for Microsoft software. Given the density of customer information now flowing into Microsoft and the variety of people now in the company, we believe that major parts of Microsoft will make the transition successfully. The transition will be bumpy, however, and other companies may compete in these new markets more successfully than Microsoft does. Third, we believe that the marginal effort required to create foreign language versions of products will increase substantially as products become more content-driven rather than feature-driven. Because 70% or so of Microsoft's retail revenues come from overseas, this is a critical issue. The movies, educational materials, financial data, news, and other types of content that new products offer tend to be country-specific and may need to change for each new international product version. In current Microsoft products, developers can produce a new international version simply by replacing one electronic file that contains English labels for dialog box buttons, menu item selections, and the like, with their foreign language equivalents. This technique is intractable, though, with multimedia products or information databases. To deal with this problem effectively, Microsoft will probably have to give significantly more financial and technical responsibility to overseas subsidiaries to develop and customize products for local markets. This would further complicate decision-making, as well as the management of product development. Fourth is the problem of over-diversification and declining market focus. Microsoft already has some 200 products and dozens more under development, ranging from games for children to video server systems for telephone and cable TV companies. This is such a broad expanse of products and markets that, surely, Microsoft cannot pay equal attention to all these diverse customers. There is a real danger that Microsoft will lose its focus and ability to build its core products, desktop operating systems, and applications. The philosophy of bang for the buck helps people concentrate on the largest, most profitable markets. This, however, is not a customer-centered or technology-centered focus. It is about money. Already we can see Microsoft having problems keeping up with Macintosh applications, one of its strongest markets. Windows products now have priority, and Microsoft bases Macintosh versions on core code designed primarily for Windows. With forethought and planning, this approach can work well, as in the case of Excel. Done clumsily, it can alienate customers, as in the case of Macintosh Word 6.0. We expect Microsoft to improve Word and other Macintosh applications out of sheer pride, if nothing else. This incident, however, may be indicative of problems Microsoft has, paying attention to small but important markets. Defining products and development processes. We see four areas of concern, all of which are common to many firms, not only in the software field, in which the principles by which Microsoft defines products and organizes their development. Feature-driven development leads to feature proliferation and underemphasizes the importance of product architectures. Product concepts and features should address user behavior as well as user activities. Allowing specifications and features to change too much hinders effective development and project management. Increasing interdependencies among product units complicate project management. One problem is that Microsoft's feature-driven approach tends to result in products that contain more features, or more new features in the case of product upgrades, than users really need. This is less true for systems products, although even Windows 95 has an abundance of new functions that have taken far longer than initially planned to develop, test, and debug. At the same time, a preoccupation with features encourages projects to underemphasize the importance of the underlying product architecture. Without a good architecture to define how components interact, it can become extraordinarily difficult and time-consuming to develop, rework, test, and debug all the different features that teams add or change. Like features, architectures need periodic updating to make it easier for teams to extend the capabilities of a product. Some Microsoft groups have realized that they must take time to refine product architectures, and have instituted a de facto milestone zero where they can do this work. Other groups rotate, with one team working on major features and architectural changes, while a parallel team works in shorter projects on minor features. Even so, intense pressure to add new features and get products completed quickly still takes time away from refining and evolving product architectures. Furthermore, Microsoft relies primarily on developers to compartmentalize functionality into components while they are writing code, rather than having a distinct high-level design phase in which to do this. Feature proliferation also causes products to grow unnecessarily in terms of memory and disk space requirements, and projects often change half of the code from one product version to the next, introducing defects and increasing testing requirements. If projects placed more emphasis on refining the existing architecture and feature designs early in each project, they would probably change and rework less code. Testing and debugging features would be easier, and the long-term product architecture would have a more coherent structure from the viewpoint of both developers and users. A second weakness is Microsoft's preoccupation with user activities rather than with user behavior. Activity-based planning provides an effective technique to analyze how people write documents, define budgets, and engage in other creation-oriented activities, and then to map these to features. This is a far better approach to defining products than having engineers dream up product concepts and features that do not match what people actually do. But because this focus on activities did not uncover the need for computer-supported collaborative work, Microsoft did not introduce a groupware product like Lotus Notes until it saw the product in the marketplace. Moreover, to move more deeply into the market of the home consumer, Microsoft and other firms need to study consumer-oriented behavior in depth to understand, for example, what types of products and services people want in fields such as entertainment, education, communication, and information or news retrieval. Then they need to introduce whole products, as well as individual features, that map to behavioral patterns, which are more difficult to measure than specific activities, such as writing a document. The contextual inquiry technique that Microsoft has used occasionally helps somewhat in analyzing user behavior, although it may be too vague and time-consuming to utilize regularly. Third is the issue of too much evolution and change in specifications. The specification document is the key mechanism for determining personnel needs and schedules. The ability to allow this to evolve and still keep projects under control is a great strength of Microsoft's development process. There are practical limits, however, and some projects go beyond these limits. As people complained about in the postmortem reports, specifications can be too sparse or change too much during a project. In these cases, project managers, as well as individual developers and testers, have trouble estimating how much time and how many people they need to build, test, and deliver the product. Similarly, if product architectures are poorly defined or become outdated, then projects will underestimate potential feature interactions, the resulting number of bugs, and the amount of testing and rework that may become necessary. We do not mean to suggest that this balance is easy to achieve. Because managers want specifications to evolve somewhat, project members may simply have to live with a high degree of schedule uncertainty, rework, and testing. They can also try to do more upfront design work, prototyping, and usability lab testing as part of the planning phase rather than as part of development, or they can schedule in more buffer time for very new or extensively changing products. A fourth weakness relates to how interdependencies among projects complicate project management. Managing one software project at a time is difficult enough, particularly when specifications and features change a lot during development. When one project depends on other projects to deliver essential components, then the complexity of manpower estimation and scheduling grows dramatically. It also becomes more difficult to catch problems through frequent build synchronizations and milestone stabilizations, unless every interdependent group stays close to its schedule and delivers components for the frequent builds to other groups. Microsoft already has trouble living by deadlines, especially in systems products. It is possible to build in more buffer time to handle uncertainties. However, this leads to longer development times. There is also the possibility that many people will sit idly by, waiting for one late group to finish its component. Interdependencies may become further complicated if more groups work away from Microsoft headquarters as a result of acquisitions or overseas customization. There are, however, solutions to these problems. Products need to have very clear architectures and interfaces among the components. Interdependent groups need to follow a disciplined development process. In other words, they cannot change critical parts of the specifications on their own, and record thoroughly in specification documents all feature dependencies on underlying components. Then they must carefully coordinate and continually review the progress of all interdependent projects. At least for some components and projects, Microsoft is already adopting these types of practices. Developing and shipping products. We can identify three main weaknesses that we have not yet touched upon under other topics that relate to Microsoft's principles for developing and shipping products. Prevent errors by building in quality rather than testing in quality, using techniques such as design reviews. Testing should emphasize typical user scenarios as well as defect detection. Effective quality and project control require quantitative metrics and reliable historical data. First, it is now a truism in management and engineering circles to say that building in quality is better than testing in quality. This is easier said than done in software. No matter how carefully a company conceives and constructs a software product, there are always potential errors or problems that only testing seems to uncover. The challenge should be to prevent errors or catch them early in a project, before they become embedded in code that becomes intertwined with other code. Microsoft, however, primarily relies on its testing process, automated quick tests, private release testing by testers, automated tests on the daily builds, tests of the milestone builds, and so forth, to catch errors. Projects also allow features to change and evolve, a policy that creates lots of errors due to poorly understood feature interactions, even if everyone codes individual features correctly. Microsoft also conducts relatively few formal or intensive reviews of specifications, designs, or code. Newcomers usually have their code reviewed by a mentor or team lead, and developers often ask one other person to check over their code. Critical features or shared components usually undergo specification reviews. But Microsoft could probably avoid some rework and testing not only by paying more attention to how features interact, but also by reviewing specifications and code more intensively. Of course, if specifications and code change significantly during a project, which they do in Microsoft, then some of the time spent doing reviews will be wasted. There is no easy solution to this problem. Nonetheless, numerous organizations, such as IBM, TRW, and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, have published studies that document the effectiveness of design and code reviews including intensive code reviews called inspections. They have found these useful in detecting and fixing problems before developers incorporate them into the product. Reviews also help refine product architectures and feature designs on a continual basis, and they educate junior developers about design and implementation techniques, as well as product details. Second is the scope of user testing that Microsoft and other software companies still need to do. For Windows 95, as previously discussed, Microsoft launched an unprecedented beta test that involved up to 400,000 customer sites examining pre-release versions of the product. This type of information comes too late to make major changes in a product. It is useful, however, to detect problems that typical users might encounter with different combinations of hardware and applications programs. Microsoft's in-house testers could never hope to replicate these diverse user scenarios in a reasonable amount of time and at an acceptable cost. The massive Windows 95 beta testing effort is an exception in the company and in the industry. In the past, Microsoft has run into problems with products such as MS-DOS 6.0 and Macintosh Word 6.0 that earlier and more extensive testing with customers and in different user scenarios might have detected. Part of the problem is within Microsoft, which has sometimes relied too heavily on its own non-typical employees for feedback on products before commercial release. Companies that want to move into the true mass market of novice consumers need to test all of their products in a manner that resembles more closely how the average person will use those products. A third weakness is the limited quantitative metrics and historical data that Microsoft possesses to facilitate scheduling, personnel estimations, quality analysis, and the product shipping decision. Hitachi of Japan has project data going back to the late 1960s. IBM, NEC, Toshiba, and Fujitsu have databases going back to the early 1970s. Microsoft has been in business since 1975, and its many projects collect large amounts of data, but it has yet to establish a rich set of common metrics and central databases to which all projects contribute. Over time, we expect metrics and historical data to become even more important for Microsoft. This will occur as more projects depend on other projects for components, and as customers demand higher levels of reliability, no Pentium-type bugs, for example, and more predictability in delivery dates. Learning as an organization. Microsoft has made significant progress in its efforts to learn from past experiences in product development and to share more process knowledge and components across different product groups. Here as well, however, Microsoft people themselves feel the company can do more. We highlight three concerns. Postmortems chronicle problems, but do not engage in deep analyses or implement solutions. Loosely organized companies may have trouble sharing knowledge across groups. Both too few or too many metrics and controls create problems. First, the project postmortem suggests that Microsoft people are good at criticizing themselves and identifying problems, and reasonably good at suggesting solutions. They are not as good at doing deep analyses of underlying problems or implementing solutions to ensure that groups do not easily repeat the same mistakes. Part of the problem has been Microsoft's traditional disdain for bureaucracy. There are relatively few formal training programs or written process documents to guide people, and there is no centralized quality assurance group. Microsoft is building up its training efforts and functional directors involved in product development and testing. But the best solution is to get senior project people to take this type of fundamental problem solving more seriously. We have seen movement, but not a full-scale cultural change as yet. Second, Microsoft has limited formal mechanisms for sharing process knowledge across groups. Again, this is part of the non-bureaucratic company culture, and it has positive and negative consequences. Sharing seems to occur best among narrow technical specialties, such as testing, where trading tools and techniques is clearly useful. Developers and program managers have been more reluctant to codify processes and share their know-how. Some of the problem here is the nature of design work in general, and software development in particular. It is partially art, partially science, and partially engineering. The functional directors try to encourage learning, and often they find themselves serving as little more than well-paid organizers of occasional lunches and retreats. They are writing guidelines and updating process documents, such as how to do project management, daily builds, or testing. These may, however, prove to be less valuable than the lunches, and even counterproductive if people react to them negatively. We conclude that Microsoft is still struggling to find a balance between informality and formality in promoting the sharing of knowledge. Third is a problem of balance with metrics and controls. Microsoft projects follow a small number of quantitative product and process measures. They could use more, but a company can go too far. For example, there was a proposal to replace postmortems with a 250-item questionnaire and audits done by the functional directors. This probably would have introduced a level of bureaucracy that few groups would have tolerated, and could have destroyed the tradition Microsoft has successfully created of evaluating past projects seriously and even humorously in the postmortems. We conclude that Microsoft is still struggling to find a balance between what and what not to measure and control. At the same time, improving project management and decision-making surely requires more comprehensive metrics and controls than Microsoft currently uses. Strategic challenges. Apart from weaknesses internal to the company, there are several strategic challenges that Microsoft faces. It is rare for the same firm to dominate multiple generations of a technology. New mass markets may require new skills and different competitive scenarios. Partner companies may demand a larger piece of the financial pie. Antitrust measures may restrain successful practices if a company becomes too powerful. Competitors can form alliances to counter the power of a dominant company. Other companies can create and link components, too. First, history is against Microsoft. Companies with 70 to 80% market shares, which Microsoft has for PC operating systems and the Office application suite, usually have only one way to go, and that is down. For a variety of reasons, few firms that dominate one generation of a product continue to dominate the next generation, depending on how radical the change is. Dominant companies often become so complacent, arrogant, or attached to their existing investments that they become vulnerable to major shifts in customer needs or technologies, or to threats from more nimble competitors. In particular, market positions based on de facto technical standards seem unlikely to endure in a fast-moving industry for more than a few years. The computer industry is full of companies, IBM, DEC, Wang, who failed to sustain their market advantages. We can also see this phenomenon in the histories of well-known companies such as Ford, General Motors, Xerox, and Kodak, which once had near monopolies. Recognition of this need to move forward explains why Microsoft so aggressively backed graphical user interfaces in the 1980s. It also explains why Microsoft invests so heavily in new product versions, as well as basic research, and has expanded into new businesses and formed partnerships with different types of companies. Microsoft is already unusual. It has moved from character-based to graphical computing, and remained the market leader in operating systems, as well as increased its position in applications. But any company is vulnerable to radical change. Next year, some competitor could hypothetically introduce an operating system that is compatible with every program written in the past, requires little memory, and responds to everyday language commands. This would make Windows 95 and Windows NT, as well as some of Microsoft's applications products, obsolete. We do not know when or if the PC software industry will experience such a radical shift in technology. We do not think it will be soon. Most technological change is incremental, and the future of PC software may well consist of bundles of incremental changes in technology and product usage, a type of competition in which Microsoft excels. For this reason, we believe Microsoft's lofty market position is likely to remain for at least a decade. It will probably take this long for the current generation of PC users simply to replace their machines and software. Second is the longer-term issue of whether Microsoft can acquire or cultivate the technology and other skills needed to compete in truly new arenas. There are several still evolving mass markets of great interest to Microsoft. Networked operating systems, multimedia publications and applications, home consumer products, workplace products, interactive TV, and information highway services. These may take a decade or more to reach their full potential. Microsoft is investing in and entering all of these new markets at a rapid pace. The company seems technically well-positioned in some segments, such as with Windows NT or the Microsoft Network, yet it seems unlikely to dominate so many new areas. Novell dominates corporate networking, Intuit dominates personal finance, and Lotus dominates office groupware. A variety of companies, such as CompuServe, owned by H&R Block, Prodigy, owned by IBM and Sears Roebuck, America Online, and MCI Communications, are far more experienced in online services. Other companies, such as Oracle and Hewlett-Packard, have advanced capabilities in video server technology. Many companies around the world are more skilled in telecommunications. And video game companies, such as Nintendo and Sega, have the ability to produce incredibly powerful and cheap home computers, as well as entertainment software for truly novice consumers, children. These and many other firms all want a piece of Bill Gates's vision of the future. Of course, to be successful in its investments, Microsoft does not have to reach an 80 or 90% share of these vast new markets, or even a 40 or 50% share, although critics may hold Gates up to this high standard. In balance, therefore, Microsoft has everything to gain by exploring new, rapidly growing markets. This is true, even if it comes in no better than second, third, or fourth in most of them, and even if it remains primarily a provider of PC operating systems and a few basic applications, with an online network thrown in as a side business. Conversely, no company is better positioned than Microsoft to offer customers a bundle of products and services that integrate functions from operating systems, applications, and network communications programs. With this type of integration possible, Microsoft's position as the provider of the PC software infrastructure may become more rather than less valuable over time and be easily leveraged across these different arenas. A third challenge may come from current Microsoft partners who want a bigger piece of the financial pie. For example, home banking and other online consumer services will clearly be part of the infrastructure package that Microsoft will offer. Even if it does not own much of the content, Microsoft will be able to charge for each transaction, rather than just selling individual products. But Compaq and other high-volume PC hardware manufacturers may resist paying Microsoft to bundle software products that generate additional revenues primarily for Microsoft. Hardware companies may demand part of the royalties or actually start charging to bundle certain types of programs, such as those that generate fees from connections to the Internet or online services. This would be a radical reversal of long-standing practices for licensing software. Other partner companies for the information highway, such as cable TV companies, telephone companies, banks, content providers, and the like, may all want more money if the electronic network market keeps growing in size and value. There should be enough money to go around, but software producers like Microsoft may not get as much as some people now believe. A fourth issue is that of antitrust concerns, and whether Microsoft will continue to alter its behavior given that government antitrust officials and judges are closely watching. Competitors are also anxious to bring complaints to government authorities. Novell did this in Europe, leading to the 1994 consent agreement discussed earlier. Several companies also funded a report that helped the U.S. Department of Justice oppose Microsoft's attempt to acquire Intuit. Other companies are combining forces to make sure Microsoft does not exploit its own online network. Many large and small companies, including Apple, frequently file suits claiming that Microsoft has stolen or illegally copied their technology. A recent Apple suit, for example, stopped Microsoft from distributing certain parts of its Video for Windows developer kit. The complaint alleged that Microsoft illegally used elements of Apple's QuickTime for Windows multimedia technology. These threats and constant vigilance, we think, will make it more difficult for Microsoft to continue orchestrating the evolution of the industries in which it competes. It will be more difficult for Microsoft to bundle products and acquire more companies. And future confrontations with the U.S. Department of Justice and federal courts may force more changes in how Microsoft operates. Even the July 1994 consent agreement, which Microsoft agreed to follow, even though a U.S. federal judge did not initially ratify it, will make it financially easier for hardware vendors to offer alternatives to Windows, such as OS 2 or Apple's operating system for the Macintosh. And Microsoft clearly has vulnerabilities. It has failed to sell successfully some products, such as LAN Manager and Money, that are outside its traditional areas of expertise. The 1994 agreement is limited, however. Microsoft remains free to form alliances with customers, offer volume discounts, bundle and discount products, preempt the competition with future product announcements, and acquire more companies. It will be difficult to stop Microsoft from designing applications products to its advantage, offering new tools and languages to support its products, or utilizing the knowledge its programmers have of Windows. Furthermore, Microsoft can still use the banner of Windows compatibility to boost sales of its applications products, operating systems, and even hardware devices, such as a new natural keyboard introduced in 1994. If there is a new consent agreement in the future, it will surely place more restrictions on Microsoft, but how many and to what effect are not yet clear. Any settlement should balance the need to foster competition, which generally benefits consumers, except when there is market confusion over standards, as in the case of VHS versus Beta in video recorders, with the danger of placing too many restrictions on perhaps the most internationally competitive company in the United States. A fifth concern is that competitors may continue to gang up on Microsoft and eventually succeed in reducing its influence. Examples of this are the agreement between former arch-rivals Apple and IBM to develop a common PowerPC, and Apple's decision to reverse a decade-old policy and license the Macintosh software to other firms in order to create its own clone market. Many other competitors appear eager to pool resources to take on the most powerful firm in their industry. IBM has acquired Lotus and the Hot Notes product. Novell, WordPerfect, and Borland Spreadsheet Division merged to counter Microsoft Office. Lotus and AT&T have formed a partnership to bundle notes with AT&T network software. Aldus and Adobe merged in printing fonts. Apple, IBM, WordPerfect, Novell, and Lotus have proposed an alternative to OLE. Apple, AT&T, IBM, and Siemens are creating a standard to allow telephones and computers to connect to each other, duplicating some of the capabilities of Microsoft at Work and Windows 95. Other alliances include various efforts to make workstations as well as video game machines more competitive with desktop PCs. In the information highway arena, there exist many powerful competitors and partnerships that do not include Microsoft. Sixth is Microsoft's vulnerability to component-level competition. Building products from components that multiple projects can share is efficient technically and allows a company like Microsoft to offer customers a lot of functionality at a low price. If the sharing mechanisms are available in the marketplace, though, other companies can build components that compete with Microsoft's components. This is technically feasible within the Windows architecture, which enables different products and components to work together. The increasing diffusion of OLE makes this even easier to achieve. Microsoft's strategy is to integrate products into packages or suites, then discount the price. This dissuades customers from buying different products and doing this sort of component substitution, such as buying both Excel and WordPerfect and using these together, rather than just buying Microsoft Office or Novell's Perfect Office or Lotus's Smart Suite for half the price. It is certainly possible, however, for competitors to create highly innovative products, such as for groupware functions or networking, then link these into Microsoft products and sell them instead of Microsoft's alternatives. This opportunity arises whenever Microsoft does not offer components that are comparable in price and functionality to those of its competitors. Attacking the future. Microsoft has always faced technical and marketing hurdles as it follows perhaps its most basic strategy. Attack the future. We have described a bit about what the company is doing in research and new product development. But what product and user scenarios is Microsoft likely to pursue beyond what it has already announced? What technical skills does it need? We now address these issues, relying on our own observations and speculation, and not on proprietary or confidential information from Microsoft. Given everything that the company is doing in its systems, applications, consumer, and research groups, we believe that Microsoft is laying a foundation to offer the consumer an unprecedented level of integration and access for all its products and services. This integration and product access can build on the MS-DOS Windows user base and the Windows family technology. It can also extend offerings already existing or under development as part of Microsoft Office and the Microsoft Home product line, as well as products like the integrated Bob application and the new Microsoft Network. More specifically, we believe Microsoft has the capability to do the following. Shift its target market from people who create things to people who consume things. Develop increasing numbers of products that include both upfront purchase prices and per-activity or per-transaction fees. Package almost all products into a few simple unified offerings that appear in new versions nearly every year. Blur the distinctions among the functions provided by formerly separate applications, operating systems, and network products. Remove many of the differences among underlying computer hardware platforms, televisions, and cable TV systems. Consumer market emphasis. Microsoft seems to be shifting its market emphasis to people who consume things as opposed to people who create things. Products like Office primarily support people engaged in creation activities, people who write letters, reports, memos, and books, people who produce and analyze budgets and data in various forms, people who make presentations, slideshows, diagrams, and the like. The current Office product supports these creation-oriented activities extremely well, and that is one reason why this product has 70% of the application suite market. Most people in the world, however, spend more time consuming things than they spend creating things. What do people consume? They consume entertainment, information, educational materials, communication, and financial data, among other things. Microsoft people also appear to believe that this consumer market for software in the home will increase dramatically in the years to come. Accordingly, the company will likely push broad, integrated products that meet these consumer-oriented needs. Microsoft Bob, which packages together basic programs for the home, is a step in this direction. A more advanced version of this might itself be called Microsoft Home, as an analog to Microsoft Office. Names that Microsoft considered for the Bob product actually included Home Foundation and Essential Home, so our suggestion is not outlandish. A more advanced product would contain more sophisticated personal, family, and household features in a variety of categories, such as the following. Communication, electronic mail and electronic bulletin boards, groupware for exchanging messages, sharing ideas, and keeping track of family information and ties, entertainment, popular entertainment programs such as movies or games, sports scores, and game analyses. Financial, tax, and budget planning software. Stock market quotes, electronic banking, and bill paying. Education. Popular educational book titles, including those for children and adults. Access to public libraries, databases, and government publications. Information. Internet access software, such as through the Microsoft Network. Access to electronic versions of newspapers, magazines, and books. Travel. Airline and train schedules and reservation services. Hotel information and reservation services. Over the next decade, it is likely that a home computer will become an indispensable household item, an appliance or tool that a person uses several times every day. The household computer will deliver a world of knowledge and sensational experiences to every user. Of course, Microsoft will continue to expand the individual desktop and office market that has been instrumental in the company's success. Most new market volume, however, will probably come from as-yet untapped home consumers. The potential installed base of such a Microsoft Home or Advanced Bob product includes all households in the developed world. These consumer-oriented software products embody many content issues. The value added by the software depends on the content it delivers, such as works of art, videos, news, or stock market data. Microsoft will either have to generate more of this content itself, very difficult in many cases, or continue to acquire or license it from other sources. An underlying technical problem is that much of the content inherently reflects country-specific culture or interests. We have noted that Microsoft and other companies cannot offer these products in foreign markets simply by changing the native language on the dialogue boxes or user interface screens. For example, French consumers probably do not want an electronic version of the U.S. Farmer's Almanac. They want electronic versions of materials relevant to France. In addition, many of these products will combine video with text and sound. These multimedia products are more difficult to design than conventional software products. Microsoft already has some experience from developing the Encarta Encyclopedia and other multimedia products, but it needs to expand this experience base to different product groups throughout the company. Products with both purchase prices and per-activity fees. In the future, we believe that the pricing for many home consumer software products will include both an upfront purchase price and a per-activity or per-transaction fee. When people buy a software product today, they pay a purchase price, for example, $100, and then own a license to use the software. In most cases, the customers can use that software an unlimited number of times for as many years as they desire. We expect, however, that much of the software in a Microsoft Home-type product will also require small fees, such as 25 cents, that users will pay each time they use particular features or services that are part of an online network. These fees will occur because many of the consumer software products require access to or usage of some external service or product that is not part of the original product. Examples include accessing a movie owned by a Hollywood studio, retrieving checking account information from a local bank, or referencing an electronic newspaper from a publisher in New York. These external dependencies contrast with today's products that provide predominantly standalone functions, such as creating a document or changing a spreadsheet. The possible financial rewards for charging per transaction or per activity fees are enormous. As a simple case, let's say that sometime during the next few years, 100 million people worldwide are using a new version of Windows or Windows NT. This number is not unrealistic. Windows has about 70 million users today, and MS-DOS about 140 million. And Windows 95 should eventually come bundled on 30 million or so computers each year. If just 1 out of 10 of these people logs on to the Microsoft network, then Microsoft will have 10 million users of its network. Each person might select on average 2 services per day, such as paying a bill and checking the stock market prices, or checking the sports scores and viewing a movie. If the fee to Microsoft for each transaction is 25 cents, then the company would receive $5 million in revenue per day. That is $1.8 billion per year, about the same size as Microsoft Office revenues in 1994. If twice as many users sign up and use 4 services a day on average, then daily revenues quadruple and would come to over $7 billion per year, or over 50% more than Microsoft's 1994 level of sales. If fees increase to 50 cents per transaction, we have $14 billion in revenues if usage levels remain the same. What is attractive about this market is the potential for multiplicative revenue increases. The number of users times the number of fee-based transactions times the price. Of course, Microsoft will have costs associated with these revenues. It must buy content or pay royalties to the various studios, banks, publishers, artists, and other organizations that provide these products and services. It will have to pay fees to carriers, such as telephone companies or cable TV providers. It may have to pay hardware companies that bundle this type of software on new PCs. Microsoft must also fund the development of software to surround these services and have people available to answer customer questions. Nonetheless, the potential for large profits is many times what Microsoft can earn for charging a customer once for purchasing a specific software product. In terms of technical hurdles, many of these per-transaction products require real-time software functions, meaning that the computer software and hardware must consistently complete a specific function within a fixed time interval. For example, if consumers want to view a movie, pay a bill, make a purchase, or get a stock price quote, they expect up-to-date results in a matter of seconds. Developing real-time software is common for telecommunications companies or defense industry producers. It is not common for a PC software firm, although networked multitasking operating systems like Windows NT and Windows 95 have some real-time functions or similar capabilities, as do some sophisticated applications, such as multimedia or relational database management products. Successful development of advanced real-time software requires a deep mathematical understanding of the types of requests users make. It also requires the ability to model those functions mathematically and then simulate them on a computer early in the product development cycle as part of the requirements analysis and specification process. Companies must also do considerable work on product architectures and component interfaces to make sure the system works without any glitches. Microsoft does not normally do mathematical analysis, computer simulations, and extensive architectural design work in its applications projects. The research division has hired some people with these skills, but Microsoft and other PC software makers will need more of these people in various parts of the organization if they want to create lots of real-time transaction features. Products packaged into a few unified offerings. The trend in Microsoft and other PC software companies is to bundle together multiple products into a smaller number of unified or integrated product offerings. We can see this in Office and Bob, as well as in Windows and MS-DOS, which now contains screensavers, communications functions, task organizer software, data compression software, and the like. We expect Microsoft to continue bundling many separate products into Windows, Office, and future versions of Bob, or our hypothetical Microsoft Home, with varying degrees of integration. This means that most customers will not buy Excel, Word, or Complete Baseball in isolation anymore. They will probably buy Windows, Office, or Bob, Home. Each of these major unified products may also have annual model changes, analogous to the yearly release of new automobiles, with new features or improved ease of use. Revenues will be substantial if most people buy the latest product version every year, or at least every other year, and prices might be low enough to make this happen. Ordinary consumers do not want to have to be software experts to evaluate what products to buy. And Microsoft wants to make the purchasing decision really simple. If the year is 1997 and the software is for use in an office, then customers should buy Office 97 and Windows 97 if they don't have this already. If the year is 1997 and the software is for use in a home, then they should buy Home 97 or Bob 97. Annual unified product versions will cause a web of inter-product dependencies internally at Microsoft and result in the development of product fragments or components integrated using a skeleton type of architectural framework. Small teams, no more than 10 to 15 developers, should be able to create most of these product fragments in short 6-month or so development cycles. Larger, more sophisticated features and architectural changes will require multi-year development cycles. If this is the case, then major new features in the software would appear only every other year, or even less frequently for Windows. We expect that many parallel multi-year projects will stagger their results so that the annual product offerings contain enough new features to attract buyers each year. Daily builds will become more difficult to carry out in this scenario, as Microsoft has already found out with Office and Windows 95. Microsoft will probably also need a dedicated build team, even for applications projects, to coordinate across the product fragments and the multi-year projects. We would expect projects to use a combination of daily builds for individual or closely coupled components, as well as weekly builds for multiple components and whole systems. Blurring of applications, operating systems, and networks. We have noted that there is a trend in Microsoft to blur the distinctions among functions provided by previously separate layers of software products. The logic behind this integration is simple and elegant. As we discussed in Chapter 3, there are three primary layers: applications that run on top of operating systems that sit on top of the hardware, and network communications programs that connect individual users to other users or to online networks. A user should not care which type of software or how many software programs an activity or a particular feature requires. Microsoft should also want these distinctions to be invisible to its customers. Moreover, it should want to use basic products like the operating system or mass-market applications like Office or Bob to extend its market reach into new areas such as networking and information highway services. Microsoft is strong in operating systems and in standalone applications, but it is a relative newcomer to the network market. The new frontier for software, however, consists of networking products and services. These include software that links users within one office or company, as well as software that connects users to the global internet and other outside online networks. If Microsoft continues to blur the distinctions among traditional software layers, then its customers will be able to communicate with other users and access online products and services in one or two painless steps, directly from within the operating system or an application program. Of course, Novell, AT&T, DEC, and other network software providers would like to keep traditional layers of software distinct so that they can sell networking programs as totally separate products. And CompuServe, Prodigy, America Online, and other companies would like to retain these distinctions as well so that they can continue to sell their online network services as separate from the operating system and applications provider. The logical extreme of the unified product packaging strategy of Office, Bob, and Windows could lead to the creation of a single product, a Microsoft 2000. This might include all the software products that most users would ever want to buy. While this level of bundling and integration may seem far-fetched, it is technically feasible. It also provides a simple packaging and marketing scheme. Hypothetically, someone at Microsoft could try to bundle a single mega glob of software with every PC made on Earth. Antitrust concerns will probably prevent Microsoft from adopting this strategy too overtly. Still, the future direction is unmistakable. Microsoft and other companies will continue to integrate functions and features now found in separate applications, operating systems, and network products. We also think that Microsoft is in an excellent position to build various hooks into its operating systems and applications products to enhance the performance of various products that customers can buy later. The hooks will let customers create their own integration of software, should they so desire. As long as the sharing mechanisms remain open, such as DLL or OLE standards, customers will be able to incorporate components from other companies as well. To make this strategy work to Microsoft's advantage, the company will need to become more expert in networking and electronic communications technology. Consumer-oriented products and services require the capability to send and receive tremendous amounts of data continuously and reliably. Future networking products must overcome current technical and logistical limits in the capacity and reliability of existing networks, which mostly run on a mix of telephone lines, cable, and optical fiber. Microsoft has also aggressively pursued partnerships with cable TV companies, which have a network infrastructure with more capacity than current telephone lines. Another longer-term alternative is to link up with cellular telephone companies that have access to satellite networks. One potential example of this is Bill Gates's partnership with Craig McCaw, founder of McCaw Cellular Communications, in the Teledesic venture. The plan is to link hundreds of satellites around the globe into a massive digital communications network, with PCs or other handheld computers as the basic communications device. Blurring of computers, TVs, and cable systems. Beyond making the distinctions among operating systems, applications, and networks less obvious, we expect that Microsoft will try to remove many of the remaining differences among underlying computer hardware platforms, televisions, and cable TV access. In the future, when users want entertainment or news, they should be able to turn to their computers and not need a television set or cable TV access. Broadcast television and cable television will still exist, but consumers will view them on their computers. This is already possible with an attachment to a PC that costs several hundred dollars. Television networks, movie studios, and cable companies will continue to produce programming content, but they will no longer provide or control the computer-based delivery or viewing mechanisms. At least some home computers in the next few years will have large, high-precision color monitors that reproduce pictures, video, graphics, music, voice, data, and text with pristine accuracy. These monitors will be flat-panel displays, similar to the displays on today's notebook computers, but they may measure as much as 2 feet by 3 feet and be only a few inches deep. Many vendors will produce the underlying computer chips that drive the display monitors. Differences in the chips apparent to consumers will simply be price and performance, not the architectural incompatibilities and look and feel subtleties that exist today between machines like a Windows PC and the Macintosh. Computers could run future versions of Microsoft Bob as the application and Windows as the operating system and network. Users will not know or care, but elsewhere on the network, outside of their home, back-end or server computers might be running a future variant of Windows NT. The servers will provide storage, retrieval, and connectivity functions for the multitude of online products and services available. In order to deliver on this integrated computer TV cable vision, Microsoft will have to delve deeper into the multifaceted problems of multimedia and real-time systems, as well as high-capacity data storage devices and displays, all of which need to run reliably over a network of computers. These products cannot simply display static text or data. They must provide realistic experiences, mimicking the sights and sounds of everyday life. Microsoft has already demonstrated these types of products and technical capabilities in prototype form or in shipped products. It has yet to put them together and make them so reliable, cheap, and simple that any computer novice can use and pay for them. But we have not described anything that is not feasible today. One important question is whether Microsoft can build more than just prototypes of the complex software components underlying these new products and services. The software needed to make the Microsoft network into a new tool for tens of millions of people must integrate multimedia content, real-time transactions, and network communications functions. It must have no major flaws. It must also be very easy to use and inexpensive. Microsoft will be competing with large-scale telecommunications producers that have their own set of customers and experienced network and online service providers and other companies that have more technical expertise in networks and real-time software. And the software technology is only one dimension. Microsoft must continue to gain access to different types of content. It must also understand the behavior of the novice home consumer and feed this understanding back to marketing as well as product planning and development. We think Microsoft will do well over the next decade because the company has many strengths that it can use to attack the future. Microsoft will continue to develop a flurry of new products and online services, and most will be competitive and improve over time. The company is acquiring new people, skills, and partners at a rapid pace. To do as well in the future as it has in the past, however, will not be easy. Microsoft will have to lead in creating the next generation of PC software technology, or it will fall victim to change and time, a more common fate for dominant firms. We really have no idea if Microsoft will still be around 20 or 30 years from now. It has a long way to go before it reaches the longevity of Ford, General Motors, or IBM, all founded in the early 20th century. Other global giants, such as AT&T, NEC, Toshiba, and Siemens, date back more than 100 years. Nonetheless, Microsoft has already made a huge mark on history after merely 2 decades of existence. Competitors, government regulators, and not a few customers fear Microsoft will abuse its considerable influence. We think that a combination of antitrust regulations and market forces, competition and user vigilance, will probably keep Microsoft in check and allow the company to continue building better and cheaper products. As the usage of PCs becomes ubiquitous in the home as well as in the office, the world's most powerful software company may someday become the world's single most powerful company in any industry. This will be much to the chagrin of competitors. But it will clearly be to the credit of Bill Gates, his senior management team, and the thousands of Microsoft people who make the company work so well. This concludes the reading of Microsoft Secrets, How the World's Most Powerful Software Company Creates Technology, Shapes Markets, and Manages People, by Michael A. Cusimano and Richard W. Selby. Copyright 1995 by Michael A. Cusimano and Richard W. Selby. This book was read by David Drummond. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Simon & Schuster Incorporated and was produced in 2016 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.